Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Moto Casino.
Social casino. E-books! Let me go back now to reading from Ian Moore, who gives us the most detail all about that day, and then we'll sort of round up. So, Friday, the 25th of October, 1415, the feast of St. Crispin and St. Crispian. Mortimer says, quote, "It is unlikely that Henry slept. At the best of times, he needed very little rest. In the hours before dawn, he probably stayed in his house in Maisoncelles, discussing the battle ahead with members of his council, hearing reports of the attack of the Count of Richemont, and waiting for the return of the scouts he had sent to spy out the land during the night. Before dawn, wearing his armour, he attended his first mass of the day, sung by the priests of the royal chapel. He heard two more masses, then rose from his knees and lifted his helmet and spurs. He ordered an esquire to take 10 men-at-arms and 20 archers and to guard the houses of the baggage wagons, which would remain in Maisoncelles. They would also guard the high-status pages and the army and the sick who could not fight. Outside, it was growing light. It was time for the army to move out. Henry called for his horse, a small white one, and rode with his councillors through the mud in the village towards the battlefield. The sodden remains of the overnight bonfires were around them. Captains were raising and ordering the men who had sheltered in the tents and in the barns and in the gardens and orchards. Henry instructed his trumpeters to remain quiet. He did not want the French to hear the English, nor to break the solemn air about the camp. Just as the English had passed the night in disciplined silence, so now they grouped together to face the French without a sound. Further up the field, about 3/4 of a mile away, the French were also deploying their men. Like the English, few of them had slept. Some of the English soldiers had heard them talking and shouting through the night as they reorganised themselves in the rain. Many were soaked and tired. Some remarked that their horses had not neighed all night, as if sensing some calamity would befall them. But the lords, who were drier, were far more positive. They had succeeded in trapping the King of England. Tomorrow they would lead him and the Dukes of York and Gloucester to Paris and Rouen as prisoners of the King of France. In arranging their forces, the French seemed largely to have ignored the royal plan drawn up at Rouen a few days earlier. They had stated that the Duke of Bourbon, the Marshal of France, Boucicault, and Gaillard Dauphin were to lead the vanguard, and the main battle was to be led by the Duke of Orléans, with the Dukes of Brittany and Alençon and the Constable d'Albret. The third battle, the rearguard, was to be led by the Duke of Bar and the Counts of Nevers, Charlois, and Vaudemont. Thus the original plan was for three battles, plus the two wings and the special cavalry, to be led by the Seneschal of Hainaut. The plan had to be adapted to a certain extent, as the Duke of Brittany, the Count of Charlois, and Tenaguer de Castel had not yet arrived, but also there were lords who were ardent for glory and did not want to be in the rearguard. Those at the front, in the vanguard, would see all the best action and capture all the most valuable prisoners. Whoever managed to seize the King of England would not only become famous, but very wealthy. Subsequently, many of those in the rearguard and main battle asked to be in the vanguard. Most of them got their way. In hindsight, too many of them got their way, it seems. The result was that the French started arranging themselves in just two proper battles, one huge vanguard of about 4,800 to 5,000 men-at-arms, and the main battle, as it was termed, consisting of about 3,000 men-at-arms. 600 men-at-arms gathered on each wing with their backs against the woods on each side. There may also have been men-at-arms in the rearguard, but if so, there were no more than 600 of them. Some sources claim there were crossbowmen in the vanguard, but other chroniclers indicate that the French lord's eagerness to take prisoners meant that they placed their archers in the rearguard, just ahead of the infantry and pages, who were with the wagons and baggage. One source expressly notes that the 4,000 crossbowmen who were originally intended to be at the front to begin the battle were given permission to depart by the lords, and they would not be needed. Presumably, they took up their position in the rear. The author of the Gesta notes that they shot from the back and wings of the French army, and their bolts did little damage. Not long after dawn, the French were ready. So many men were in the vanguard that the lines stretched right across the field and into the woods on both the Agincourt and Tramacourt sides. As a result, the 600 men-at-arms on each wing had to stand forward of the vanguard. So already, immediately, there's just simply not enough room for the whole French army. It's too packed, Mortimer goes on. In order to make their lances more rigid and easier to wield in a relatively confined space, they were told to cut the narrow end off the wooden lance and fix the steel head back on the sturdier shortened shaft. The lack of room may also have led to the decision to send the crossbowmen to the back of the army. They could not help but be charged down by the French knights if they were at the front. Besides, the French decided they would not need their crossbowmen to break up the English formation. They would do that with the heavy cavalry, as the Rouen plan had instructed. So here we're told there are a fair amount of cavalry. Now, one of the other historians we read a moment ago said there was almost none, or if there were any, they were sort of on the flanks. So you see different historians imagine what went down a bit differently, because the original accounts are a bit conflicting. They don't all perfectly marry up and line up to paint one single clear picture. Mortimer continues, to what extent these decisions were those of the Duke of Orléans, who was still a month short of his 21st birthday, is unclear. One has to presume that he listened to the advice of the experienced military men like Bouchicault and d'Albret, and weighed it up against the advice of the other royal dukes, Bourbon and Bar. But this generalship by advisory committee was bound to lead to difficulties. It was probably the reason why so many men went into the vanguard. The young Duke of Orléans no doubt thought that he should take a leading position in the vanguard, and so positioned himself at the front, rather than in the main battle. This was, after all, an opportunity for him to demonstrate to the absent Duke of Burgundy that he and the Armagnacs would uphold the honour of France. Having thus broken the plan set at Rouen, it was difficult to prevent the other important lords from taking their places in the vanguard too, if they so wished. This was a great mistake, for it resulted in the crossbowmen being crowded out and sent to the back of the army, where they proved ineffective. Such errors indicate that there was no real generalship in the French army, there was only politics. Again, terrible way to do battle. Endless examples in history of where politics got in the way of decent tactics, or just common sense even. Mortimer again. This advisory committee form of generalship led to other problems. For example, when exactly should the fight begin? Although the Count of Richemont had arrived with his Breton troops, his brother, the Duke of Brittany, had not. Everyone expected that Brittany would arrive shortly, not knowing that he had no intention of turning up at all. In the meantime, his absence raised the question of whether the French should attack straight away or wait. The same question had been discussed the previous day when the two sides had first faced each other. The Duke of Bourbon and other courtiers were all then for attacking immediately. The experienced military men, most notably the constable and the marshal, were more wary and inclined to wait for the rest of the army. This was wise counsel, for the Seigneur de Longwy was still 18 miles away with the 600 men-at-arms of the Duke of Anjou. As for the Duke of Brabant, he was still at Long, 30 miles away. To be exact, at prime, about 7 o'clock in the morning, he was attending Mass. At the moment he took Holy Communion, one Robert Jewell hurried into the chapel to tell him that the battle with the English would take place before midday. Immediately, the Duke told his companions to mark their clothes with the White Cross and set out to fight. Another failing that arose from the lack of generalship was the choice of battleground. The French might have succeeded in cutting off the English advance to Calais, but in doing so, they had placed themselves in a narrow, confined space between two woods, and with ground sloping away on either side. Moreover, they were encamped in a ploughed field that had turned into a quagmire as a result of the recent heavy rain. The conditions were going to get worse, with thousands of horses churning up the ground. The ground between the two armies was no firmer and dangerous for galloping horses. Orléans did not have the experience to order a change of location, and no one else had the authority to suggest they move. No doubt some lords said that it would be dishonourable to back away in order to find better ground, especially when they had six times as many men-at-arms as the English. I remember Ian Mortimer said it was probably only 2-1 a few pages ago. And now he's saying, at least in terms of men-at-arms, it's 6-1. Okay, he carries on saying, those aware of the danger might have found it difficult to suggest a better place to do battle, but the experienced military men could suggest nothing but waiting. The English were dispirited and hungry, and they relied on being attacked, i.e. responding to a French advance. The French could continue to starve them in the field. They had time on their side. The French had time on their side, that is. As Henry rode out of Maisoncelle on his small white horse and looked across the field towards the French lines, he saw the undulations of the terrain and realised how the ground fell away to the trees on either side. There was scope there for arranging an ambush to distract the charging French cavalry. His scouts would have informed him how soft the ground was and how slippery. But now he would have seen the churned up mud for himself. He also would have seen the lines of the French vanguard forming up ahead of him. Their spears like a forest, quote, and the wings of mounted cavalry extended towards him. The task facing him must have seemed daunting. The English army began to form up in the same three battles as they had marched from Harfleur. The vanguard under the Duke of York took the right-hand side of the field, the Tramacourt side. Henry himself would lead the main battle, which formed up in the centre, and on the left-hand side of the field, the Agincourt side, the rearguard formed up under the command of the old but experienced Sir Thomas Lord Camoy. The archers hammered their sharpened wooden stakes into the ground before them and presumably resharpened the points, hoping thereby to prevent a direct onslaught of the French cavalry. On their flanks were thorn bushes and hedges, and directly in front of them was a small depression in the ground, meaning that anyone riding against them would have a short but decidedly uphill struggle at the end before hitting the sharpened stakes. This position was defensible and the best to withstand a French charge. As the hour approached prime, i.e. 7 o'clock in the morning again, the last arrangements were made to bring the army into a state of readiness. The archers were ordered to replace their bowstrings, lest the ones they currently have are wet. On the right flank, Henry sent an esquire with 200 archers to skirt around the bushes and hedges and to hide in the woods on the Tramacourt side. On the left flank, he sent a group of men-at-arms to conceal themselves in the woods on the Agincourt side. Those archers in the battle centre were placed to the sides of it into wedge or triangular formations close to the archers on the wings. This served to create a tapering corridor through which any French troops would have to charge directly to reach Henry. They would not be able to sweep across the field towards him or come at the main battle from an angle due to the stakes as well as the archers themselves. So yeah, very much funneling the French towards the middle where they want to go anyway because that's where the king is, their main priors. So Henry's sort of doing everything right. His battle craft, his setup is very, very good, almost perfect. Mortimer goes on. This was important, as Henry knew that the prime objective of the French was to capture or kill him. He had experienced a similar situation when fighting at Shrewsbury in 1403. On that occasion, Henry's father had employed the tactic of having two men-at-arms clothed in royal armour so that the enemy could not tell which man was actually the king. Guillaume Gruel's Chronicle of the Life of the Count of Richemont asserts that Henry employed the same tactic at Agincourt. This was probably an unfounded assertion based on a later malicious attempt to detract from Henry's military reputation. Nevertheless, the idea it emboldens that the person of the king was all important to the outcome of the battle was undoubtedly true. Hence, at the centre of the main battle was a concentrated mass of men-at-arms around the king. Here also were placed Henry's five banners, representing the Trinity, the Virgin, St. George, St. Edward the Confessor, and of course, the Royal Arms of England, and the banners of the lords whose retinues were present. There are many speeches recorded for Henry at this point. One chronicle, The Brute, has him asking what time it was. On being told that it was prime, he stated that it was a good time to be about to fight battle on behalf of England, for many people in England would be at prayer at that hour. Several other chronicles echo this. One has Sir Walter Hungerford's line about wishing for more men, together with Henry's Maccabean response, attributing the outcome to God alone. Thomas Elham's chronicle has the king recalling the victories of Edward III and his eldest son, the Black Prince, which had been won with fewer men. Thomas Walsingham gave Henry patriotic lines culled from the Roman poet Lucian. All the English writers writing long after the event, felt obliged to give Henry suitably patriotic, stirring words, proving him an inspiring leader, even though any precise recollection so long after such a tumultuous event would have been impossible, even for those who had been present. Well, maybe, maybe not. Having said this, it is worth noting that Lefebvre, who was present in the English army, noted that Henry went along the battle line making many speeches, not just one. According to him, Henry told the archers how they could fight secure in their knowledge that the war was a just one, and that the throne of France was his rightful inheritance, and that they had all been born in England, where their mothers, fathers, wives, and children now were at this very moment, and that, quote, the French had boasted that if any English archers were captured, they would cut off the three fingers of their right hand so that neither man nor horse would ever again be killed by their arrows. And while Lefebvre's account of Henry's speech has a ring of truth and has a claim of authenticity, it is difficult to know what to make of the speeches attributed to him by the other French writers. For example, Juvenal d'Ursin's version of Henry's speech has him outlining his claim to the throne of France and that it had fallen to him to make good that claim by conquest. And he's apparently supposed to have said, he had not come as a mortal enemy, for he had not consented to burning, ravaging, violating, nor raping girls and women, as they, the French, had done at Soissons, but he wished to conquer gently all that belonged to him, not to cause any destruction at all. Back to Mortimer, who says, quite how one could conquer gently is an interesting question, but more importantly, the reference to the attack on Soissons in 1414, when a victorious French army had killed large numbers of Burgundians and raped many women, French women, including nuns, shows that d'Ursin's main reason for making this point was a moral one and not simply a historical reflection. It was part of the tide of the French accusations and blame that immediately followed the battle. He went on to stress how Henry ordered his men to lay aside their personal animosities and embrace each other, implying that the French themselves should have done this, and promised his men the full value of any prisoners they took. He even went so far as to claim that Henry promised that all those fighting there that day would henceforth enjoy the same privileges as noblemen. The fact is that most of the Englishmen present would not have heard the king's speeches, only those near enough as he rode up and down the battle lines. But the importance of Henry's speech-making was not so much that he was heard by his men, as that he was seen by them. Just to know that he was there was an inspiration to many. His appearance was noted by most of the chronicles. One described him as, quote, clad in safe and very bright armour. He wore on his head a splendid helmet with a large crest, which still survives today, actually, and encompassed with a crown of gold and jewels, and on his body a surcoat with the arms of England and France, from which a celestial splendour gleamed on the one side from three golden flowers planted in an azure field, on the other from three golden leopards supported in a ruby field, sitting on a noble horse as white as snow, having also horses in waiting, royally decorated with the richest trappings, his army were much inspired to martial deeds. End quote, Mortimer continues. The king's appearance was thus of importance to both sides. For the English, it was important to know he was sharing their danger and in control of the army. For the French, the dazzling spectacle of him in his surcoat, armour and crowned helmet was the bait that would draw them charging down the corridor of stakes and archers. Henry was impatient, waiting for the French to attack. They had made no move for an hour at least. A small number of men-at-arms had ridden out from the French lines and had approached the English army at a gallop. But these had been warned off with a volley of arrows at Henry's orders. Now more riders were approaching, heralds. The English army were jittery. The time for negotiation had passed. Still, if negotiators were seen to be pursuing a dialogue, Henry had to be seen to listen to them. The chroniclers, writing about these negotiations at a later date, concealed the terms under layers of post-battle propaganda. Some French writers claimed that Henry had previously sent his heralds to the French army, asking for safe passage to Calais, offering to cede Harfleur and the castles below Calais to restore the prisoners he had taken and to pay 100,000 crowns in recompense. Obviously, none of the English writers mentioned such a shameful request. In Shakespeare, they have the French herald good couple of times coming to Henry, asking whether he wants to just surrender before there's bloodshed. And, Shakespeare gives Henry great lines saying, no, the only thing the French will be able to take off of me are my bones, are my joints. You know, come and get it. Bring it on. No, I'm not surrendering. And don't come back to me again asking to, because it's on. You're the ones who have forced this. If you want to let me just go to Calais, I'll just go to Calais. But you're not letting me do that. So it's on. I'm not going to give in. I've come all this way. If it's one thing Henry V doesn't do, it's surrender. Mortimer continues, saying, Henry was impatient, waiting for the French to attack. They had made no move for an hour at least. A small number of men-at-arms had ridden out from the French lines and had approached the English army at a gallop, but these had been warned off with a volley of arrows at Henry's order. Now more riders were approaching. Heralds. The English army were jittery. The time for negotiation had passed. Still, if negotiations were seen to be pursuing a dialogue, Henry had to be seen to listen to them. Again, that's in the Shakespeare play, and a lot of the histories, all the histories really mention this, that there's still negotiations going on late into the morning. Basically, the French keep asking Henry surrender, and Henry keeps refusing to. But we'll continue the story here, saying, the chroniclers, writing about these negotiations at a later date, concealed the terms under layers of post-battle propaganda. Some French writers claimed that Henry had previously sent his heralds to the French army, asking for a safe passage to Calais, offering to cede Harfleur and the castles below Calais, to restore the prisoners he had taken, and to pay 100,000 crowns in recompense. Obviously, none of the English writers mentioned such a shameful request. Once again, that's something to mention, isn't it? That both sides, after the fact, did propagandize this thing, right? There's no doubt that it's a significant, very, very significant English victory, but still you would play it up. Still you would exaggerate it a bit for political reasons, if not just for straight up glory. And the French, of course, obviously, are going to want to try and downplay it as much as possible. Okay, negotiations of some description did take place. However, it appears most likely that the French sent negotiators to Henry. They may have offered him safe passage to Calais in return for significant concessions, including his renunciation of the throne of France, which he was never going to do. That's the whole point of this thing, is to press his claim. But the French were not serious. They were playing for time. Again, Henry wants to do it as quickly as possible, wants the battle to start as quickly as possible, and the French want to drag it out. It's in their interest. The longer it takes, the more men they're going to have, because more Frenchmen are streaming in every moment almost. Among the negotiators were Guillaume Dauphin and Jacques de Helly. When their terms had been formally presented to the English council and dismissed, the heralds were told to depart. It would appear that de Helly then offered to fight a personal duel with anyone in the English army who claimed he had escaped his custody in England against the laws of chivalry. Duels before a battle were not uncommon. It was a chance for a man-at-arms to win great prestige, fighting in front of a large crowd of soldiers. But on this occasion, it was just another delaying tactic. The troops were anxious. By now, it was probably just past 9 o'clock in the morning, and they had been standing still in their battle formations for the best part of 3 hours. So Henry tersely denied his duel and told him that he could expect to be prisoner of the English again later that same day. While these discussions were taking place, the French were also growing restless. Some men received the honour of knighthood. It was said that 500 French knights were dubbed before the battle. One of them was Philip, Count of Nevers, who was knighted by Bouchicault. 18 men in the company of the Seigneur de Croix swore an oath that when the two sides came together, they would either knock the crown off Henry's head or they would die trying. For Henry, the time wasting was a cause of concern. His men were eager to get the fight over and done with. They were starving. The author of the Gesta, sitting on a horse at the back of the army, thought the French were trying to defeat the English through hunger. Others in the ranks could not understand the reluctance of the French to do battle, considering they had so many men-at-arms. What were they doing? Perhaps this was where the rumour that the French were playing dice for the honour of imprisoning the great lords of England came from. Whatever the cause, the tension was threatening to break the discipline of the army. Henry therefore put the question to his council. What if the English were to do the unthinkable, an attack? This strategy sounds entirely logical, but it was counterintuitive to the English military mind of 1415. The textbook longbow victory was achieved by having archers on the flanks in a defensive position, just as Henry had arranged them, and shooting at the charging enemy as they approached. That had been the secret of the first massed longbow victory at Duplin Moor in 1332, and Edward III had perfected the strategy at Halidon Hill in 1333 and Cressy in 1346. Henry was simply following a technique that had been tested over the last 80 years, but to attack with massed longbows was unusual. Henry would have known it could be done on a relatively small scale. He himself had probably used the tactic in Wales, and the late Earl of Arundel had helped him win the bridge at St. Cloud through an English longbow attack in 1411, but it was a risky manoeuvre. For a start, the English would have to abandon their defensive position and move forward on foot for a distance of 700 or 800 yards. That's quite a long way, to be fair, especially if the field is all boggy and muddy and difficult to walk across. Two-thirds of the distance between the two armies. They would have to remove the stakes and reposition them while exposed to the risk of the French heavy cavalry. Shooting accurately and fast and advancing quickly in formation were incompatible. The situation was best summed up by one English chronicler in the following passage. The king, considering that a great part of the short day was already past, and firmly believing that the French were not inclined to move from their position, consulted the most experienced officers of his army whether he should advance with his troops in the order in which they stood towards the enemy that was refusing to come towards him. Having fully considered the circumstances of such an important matter, they wisely decided that the king should march with his army towards the enemy and attack them in the name of God, for they considered that the English army, very much wearied with hunger, illness, and marching, was not likely to obtain any refreshment in the enemy's country, and that the longer they remained there, the more they would suffer from weakness and exhaustion, whereas the enemy, being among friends, could easily obtain whatever they needed, and as a result of the delay, accumulated new and greater strength by the arrival of fresh troops. Therefore, the king's advisers finally concluded that further delay was damaging to the English, but advantageous to the French. The king considered it would be difficult and dangerous to leave his position, yet to avoid greater dangers, with the greatest of courage, he set his army an example of how they could march towards the enemy, preserving their current formation. He commanded that his own chaplains and all the priests of the army should start to pray, and that the heralds should attend only to their own duties and not take up arms. End quote. Mortimer continues. This account is convincing. Henry was frightened to leave his position, but he did so anyway. We have noted that Henry was extremely cautious in his strategic moves to this point. He demonstrated a high degree of caution in his choice of landing place at Harfleur. He was very cautious in his attacks on the walls of that town, preferring to blast at them rather than risk sustained assaults. After leaving Harfleur, he did not attack any other town and avoided confrontation wherever he could at Blanchequet and after leaving Peronne. So for him now to be reluctant to give up his defensive position was entirely in character and understandable. That he did so and gave the order to advance banners was a mark of outstanding courage. It proved to be the single most important decision of his life. Yeah, it does seem to be, doesn't it, that when you look at the battle as a whole, that everything Henry did kind of worked perfectly. And this is part of it. It's still the opening gambit, isn't it, really, of the battle. But it seems like it was something he needed to do. In hindsight, it was probably the perfect thing to do. Okay, Ian Mortimer continues. One struggles to imagine what went through the minds of the English archers when the word went round to advance. They, the few, hungry and fatigued, were going to advance against this seeming mass of French men-at-arms, their social and military superiors. In order for their bows to work effectively, they would certainly need to be within 200 yards of the enemy, and preferably less than half of that to shoot accurately. A charging mounted man-at-arms could cover a distance of 100 yards in 10 seconds, so the archers could be charged down before they came within effective killing range. The one advantage they had was that they could shoot rapidly. Crossbowmen in such a situation would have been helpless because they could not shoot quickly enough, but archers could loose a dozen or more arrows a minute. Against 1,000 charging knights on horseback, each weighing half a ton and travelling at 600 yards per minute, 20 miles per hour, this was crucial, for only by bringing down enough horses could they slow the charge. The question was, could the English archers get close enough to bring down enough horses? When the order was given to prepare for the banners to advance, the English were terrified but ready. All the men-at-arms had dismounted and were ready to run in their armour. Some of the archers were preparing to take their stakes with them. Others just knew that they had to advance quickly and decided to leave their stakes behind. Others were probably too scared to know what they should do. Many men were praying. Many were bending down and putting a small piece of earth into their mouths, preparing for the moment of their death and the last judgment. We hope you enjoyed that video, and if you did, please head over to lotuseaters.com for the full unabridged video.
Moto Casino, America. America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, R-I-T-E-R-U-G.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.